So you guys have heard a lot from me and from Jackie. We're gonna start this session. We just finished how you get your wine, what the logistics look like, what the three-tier system looks like, why it's hard, what some of the options might be for getting your personal wine for personal consumption. This session is gonna be focused a little bit more on giving you a history of the three-tier system so you understand why it's so hard, why we have this system and why it's in place and what it's designed to do so you can figure out where you are in that system. And talking a little bit about the specific legal issues that you get into when you try to commercialize your wine. We have a guest speaker with us today, Mike Kelly, who's from a firm in New York, so he's got a lot of New York experience, but he was also the general counsel for 25 years at Moët Hennessy.
Right.
Nobody correct my French because it's a Dutch name.
That's correct. It's Moët.
And based on his life experience, he's got a lot to add to what we've been talking about in our particular situation. When he's finished telling you what the trials and tribulations might be, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about what some of the solutions might look like. And I think from the beginning, the most important thing to understand is that you all are not normal.
You are not normal.
We're special.
You are special people. And you are in a very special situation that most of what we think about and what you hear about in the marketplace about distribution of wine comes from people like John, who have a winery, and they're in a completely different class of possibilities. So part of this is going to kind of get us oriented into, like we just, when, for those of you that were with me in the last session, we went into who we are and why we're different. We'll do that again when Mike is finished and gives us sort of an overview of how we got into this labyrinth of regulatory bliss.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me to San Francisco. It's a great town. Moët Hennessy, I used to come out here quite often. We own the Domaine Chandon, which is a California winery, obviously, in Napa.
Can you speak up, Mike?
I'll try, but my voice is a little hoarse.
I'll shout as much as I can. And we own Newton, and one time we used to own Simi, so I used to come out here regularly. I love coming back to visit this great city. Second reason I love coming here is I'm speaking to people that obviously love wine, and I'm a big wine aficionado. Like a lot of people here in college, I used to drink beer, and then when I was 25, I thought it became sophisticated, so I started drinking scotch. And then in my 30s, I started drinking wine and never looked back. One of my good friends still drinks Johnny Walker scotch, and he's always teasing me. He said, you know, I drink it on the rocks. There's no calories in it. So the first, there are no calories in wine. That's impossible. And secondly, I intend to live a lot longer than you because we all know it's good for you. And the third reason I'm happy to be here is after 25 years of Moët Hennessy, not once did I ever get invited to Argentina. We sold Terrazas wine. So I flew out from New York to meet 60 new people. I figured out at least the one out of 60 shot that one of you will take me to Argentina. So how do we end up with this crazy system? I was a little encouraged to hear this morning that Argentina is as Byzantine as the United States.
But we might want to stand over there.
Yeah.
Just because that'll help get
sure.
Some of the volume to the back.
Okay. Argentina is apparently as crazy as we are, but at least when we talk about the history, you'll understand why it is that we have the system we have, known as our infamous three-tier system. We have suppliers, wholesalers, and retailers. And believe it or not, this goes back in time to the late 1800s and early 1900s, and it's what directly led to prohibition in this country. In those days, wineries were virtually non-existent. It was the brewers that controlled the industry, and the distillers that controlled the industry, and they were the powerhouses. What happened was, both the distillers and the brewers actually controlled the saloons and the pubs. Created a real problem because the products were tied through those pubs and taverns. So if you're producing the beer or you're producing the spirit and you own the retailer, you're going to encourage that retailer to push as much spirits and beer out the system. Because of that, there was a lot of abuse. And you remember, you know, from history, all kinds of stories about working men who would go off to the pubs at lunchtime who have blow all their paychecks on beer and spirits, leaving very little for the family to survive on. There's a famous expression, no such thing as a free lunch, which I found fascinating. I learned what the genesis was. There was a rumor, at least, maybe it's a factoid, I don't know, that the saludos used to heavily salt the workman's lunch, that the lunch was free. But then he would consume about 10 beers, and at the end of the work week, there was nothing left for the wife and kids. So I'm sure you know some of this history. Women's Christian Temperance Union, religious groups took up the cause to try to stop this alcohol abuse, and it resulted in the enactment of the 18th Amendment, which prohibited importation, manufacture, distribution, and sale of alcohol other than for sacramental purposes. And believe it or not, this grand experiment of prohibition lasted for 16 years. It was an absolute disaster. It wasn't repealed until 1933. It didn't do anything to temper alcohol consumption. Speakeasies grew up all over the place, and it led to corruption at the political level, corruption at the police level, and the direct result of organized crime.
But it was great for music and dancing.
It was great if you knew something. So finally, the law is repealed by God in 1933. But coming out of prohibition, both Congress and the states were very cognizant of the quote-unquote evils that led to it, and they wanted to make sure that the new regulatory system that came out post-prohibition addressed these concerns. So a dual system of regulation was enacted, which pertains to everybody who's at the supplier or wholesale level. We're regulated by the federal government through the Alcohol, Tobacco, Tax, and Trade Bureau, and each of our states have state alcohol beverage laws that we have to comply with. So this concurrent jurisdiction. For some of the lawyers in the group, you might be accustomed to something called the Supremacy Clause, where federal laws would supersede state laws. In our world, that's not the case. You have to comply with both TTB and state law. So, what did the feds do? Congress enacted the Federal Alcohol Administration Act, which is enforced by our favorite people at TTB, and the states enacted various local alcoholic beverage control boards.
And Duffy began drinking.
Now, this is why we did the little history lesson. It's kind of an underlying premise to all of this regulation that came out after Prohibition. There's a theme here, and the theme is that both under federal and most state laws, if you're at the top tier of the industry, you're a supplier, you can't be a wholesaler, and then you can't be a retailer either. Now, there are some exceptions around the country, but this general premise to prevent this tied house where a supplier is controlling the retailer, there's an intermediary tier called a wholesaler. And one can't have an interest in another. They're all totally separate. Move on to the next one. Two systems of distribution opened up in the United States. Places like California, New York, Illinois, Texas, have an open system of distribution, which is your classic three-tier system, where you have a supplier selling to a wholesaler who then sells to a restaurant or a liquor store. They're called open states because there's another system called control. They're also called licensed states because they issue licenses to enable people to traffic in alcoholic beverages. So if you're a winery, you have a license. If you're a wholesaler, you have a license. And if you're a retailer, you have a license.
By the way, wholesaler, distributor, same thing. Same thing. Don't get confused.
Yeah.
I do.
No, I mean, I ask that question a lot. You're absolutely right. We get very sloppy in the business, but they're synonymous terms. A wholesaler is a distributor. Okay, where are we now? The reason that they're a licensed state is in these 32 states, the legislatures thought that to control the consumption, manufacture, consumption, and sale of alcohol, if they issued a license to an entity, that was something that could be taken away. If you talk to a state regulator, they always will tell you a license is not a God-given right. It's a privilege. So if you respect the privileges of the license, then you're allowed to traffic in alcohol. But if you violate the law, they could take it away. There are another 18 states. I don't know how often you all deal with this.
Often
you do, sorry. They're more painful.
Mm-hmm.
Called the control states. So that was the second method of distribution that they came up with after repeal. There was a core of states, 18, I guess maybe now it's 17 because Washington went the other way, where the legislators thought that, look, licenses are fine, but we really want to control the actual sale of alcohol. Pennsylvania is a classic example of a control state. The supplier importer actually is required to sell spirits, wine to the state. The state warehouses it, and the state then distributes through a state store system. Then elsewhere, there are hybrids around the country where you might have to sell spirits to the control board, but wine has an open distribution system. So it varies all over the country and incredibly complex. They stay out of the control states, except Pennsylvania, because they're a big buyer. Like open states, where there are ultimate controls, they can take your license if you violate the law. Control states even have a bigger power. You can't do business in a control state because they're a monopoly. You're doing business with the state. So if you're engaged in bad activity, they actually can delist your product for distribution in the state. So, what is our traditional system? We've talked about it a lot. We've got the supplier who sells to a licensed wholesaler, who then sells to the restaurants, bars, package stores, grocery stores. And of course, we know it's been around since 34.
What's the difference between on-premise?
Oh, sorry.
Off-premise?
Yeah, it's a term of art, I guess, we used at Bowhead Hennessy a lot. On-premise to me means a consumer goes on the premises to consume alcohol. And off-premise means you're going in to buy it. It's also known as a package store. You go in, they put in the package, give you a credit card, you walk off the premise and consume it. So, let's see. So under the three-tier system, the foreign winery sells its product. We've talked about this morning to the U.S. importer. In your case, or in most cases, I guess it's MHW. Then MHW in turn sells to a distributor, except in those states where they have their own wholesale licenses, which I believe are New York and California.
Right.
And then in New York and California, because they have state wholesale licenses, they have the legal authority to sell to restaurants and to package stores. New York, I talk, whenever I make a presentation, people always seem to fixate on New York for some reason. I don't know if I have the right audience for this, but I figured I'd put some slides up about New York. New York kind of has an aberrant model. It's slightly different than the classic three-tier system. In New York, an importer can get a wholesale license. So MHW can be a holder of a federal basic importer's permit and a federal basic wholesaler's permit, and they also can get a New York State wholesale license. So it's not a classic three-tier, it's almost a two-tier system in New York. And in New York, depending upon the business model that one has, if you have a wholesale license, you could either sell to other wholesalers in New York, or you could use the privileges of that license to sell to restaurants and package stores.
But not directly to consumers?
No, under no circumstances. Is there any license other than a retail license that would permit you to sell directly to a consumer? So it's a very strict system, distribution.
And New York also requires that anybody that works for a wholesaler and intends to sell wine to a retailer, that individual is licensed also, correct?
That's right. In New York, there's something called solicitor's licenses. So if you go get yourself a state wholesale license, I think I'm going to have some slides on this later.
I'm sorry.
You actually have to have a bona fide office. It has to be open during business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. You have to have somebody there to answer the phone. And your people, to the extent that they're going out into the trade, taking orders, have to have state solicitor's license.
And in this sense, what you're talking about for New York, a two-tier versus three-tier is a little unusual, but this type of regulation and these kinds of requirements to be a distributor, you see different variations of it, but they're kind of the same all over the country.
That's true.
I mean, there's a laundry list of things you have to do in order to be a distributor. It may not be exactly the same thing that you'll see in these examples of New York, but they give you an idea of what you might have to do in order to be a distributor.
And then, of course, as we talked earlier, the overriding principle in New York and in most states in the country is MHW can't be a retailer, and a retailer can't be a wholesaler or an importer. That's a very strict rule. I threw this in for the heck of it. I don't think it's of much interest to you. This was pretty much my business at Moet Hennessy, because we always had container loads. And there's something called Someday, you guys are big enough, you'll have DI orders. But what it means is you're selling direct, as the importer, you're selling directly to a wholesaler by the container load. And title passes from the supplier to the U.S. importer in South America or Europe, wherever it is, to the wholesaler. The wholesaler then has responsibility for the ship. We arrange it, but the risk of loss passes to the wholesaler when it hits the ship, and they take care of all the importation. That represents, for most big importers, maybe 90% of their business. Only 10% of the time does a big U.S. importer bring the merchandise in under their own title, clear through customs, and put it in a warehouse because of the expense. So it's really, if you get big enough, it's a great gig because it's mostly a paper transaction. We talked about this earlier. In New York, if you want a wholesale license, you have to physically have an office. A lot of people come to me and say, I want to sell at retail. And I say, oh, great, where's your lease? I don't know a lease. Can I just get a license? No. It's got to be a bona fide premises with people. Let's see. We talked about this. We talked about this bricks and mortar. This is the classic in-state New York model, but not everyone, obviously, not every supplier has an office in New York. So what do? They appoint a New York wholesaler as their exclusive brand agent. That exclusive brand agent then appoints the wholesalers the suppliers want. So if you're a supplier based in Illinois, you don't want to come to New York and get a wholesale license. You can appoint and a wholesaler in New York as your exclusive brand agent. You discuss with them what distributors you want the product to go through, and then that the exclusive brand agent will sell to those distributors that you're going into. So you don't always have to have an office, but I don't want to confuse you. If you follow that model, you can't sell to retailers. You can only sell to your exclusive brand agent.
So and there's yet another limit created.
MHW, we've talked about many times this morning, they've got the classic in-state model where they've got the wholesale import, federal basic importers and wholesalers permit, New York state license, so they can sell to wholesalers in New York and they can sell to the restaurant chain. Let's see what else we have here. Oh, on the retail end, very similar to, I get this question all the time. In New York, there's no such thing as a virtual retailer. You have to have bricks and mortar. So if you want to be in the liquor store business, you actually have to have a liquor store. If you want to be in the restaurant business, obviously, you'd be silly not to have one. But I get this question all the time, can you have a virtual liquor store in New York? You can't. You can get a liquor store license, and in New York, just not to confuse you, you can only sell wine through a liquor store. You can't buy wine at a grocery store. So you have to have bricks and mortar, you have to have a lease, and you have to be in a bona fide business open to the public. I threw this in here because there's been some inroads over the last 10 years to this very strict three-tier system, marginal. And it really came up in the context of internet sales. And of course, one of the early companies that had some success in this area was wine.com, and more are growing up every day. We'll go to the next one, I think. There's amazon.com today, Lot 18, ship compliant, is trying the business. Depending upon the state, they have more or less success. New York, this issue has just recently come up in the last 6 months, and Lot 18 and Ship Compliant filed what's called a petition for a declaratory ruling asking the state liquor authority to bless their model of doing business, and they kind of ran into a buzzsaw. And the reason that internet platform providers have a problem is we've got the system that's been around since 1934 with entrenched interests. So in New York we have, I think I have slow in somewhere, we have a very strong wholesale lobby. There's a strong national wholesale lobby called WSWA, Wine Spirits Wholesalers of America. There were also very strong retail lobbies. So with internet providers are going bypassing all of these tiers. Guess what? The wholesalers don't like it. The retailers don't like it because they're losing margin. So they put up a big fight in New York that's not yet resolved. Conversations are ongoing, and we hope it gets resolved soon. even I found this out recently, I knew Hawaiian.com was operating in New York, didn't really know how, but I found out from their general counsel that they actually own a store in New York. So they went to the trouble of actually doing the bricks and mortar. They actually lease the premises, and then from that premises they ship wine. And that's not what they do in every state. In some states, you know, there are other ways to get around it. But in New York, you have to own a liquor store. What do we have next? Direct shipping is another inroad into the three-tier system.
By direct shipping, you mean direct to consumer?
Sorry, direct to consumer. But it's kind of a narrow exception. There was a Supreme Court decision in 2005 called the Granholm decision. But again, for the lawyers in the room, it was kind of a narrow decision because it arose from a situation where a state was favoring its in-state wineries and was allowing the in-state winery to sell direct to the consumer. But if you were an out-of-state winery, they would not let you ship, say from California, to a New York consumer. So on that basis, the Supreme Court said, well, if you're going to favor local industry over out-of-state industry, it's unconstitutional. So either we're going to strike down your law, or you're going to allow the out-of-state people to ship in direct. So New York now permits, for example, if it's, maybe it's on the slide. That's not all. New York has now amended its law to allow shipment of domestic wines, not foreign wines, domestic wines, into New York directly to a consumer, provided the winery has a permit that's issued by the state of New York, and you can ship up to 36 bottles a year.
This is another way in which you all are all very special, because you're not domestic. You're not a domestic winery, you're not a domestic wine. And foreign wines get treated differently and with greater scrutiny.
Right.
The alternating
proprietorship
here?
Well, we'd say alternating proprietorship. You're talking about at a winery facility in California, for example? Right. How is that going to let you get Argentinian wine into New York, though?
I don't know. It's
that's the problem.
You'd have to make the wine there.
Right. You have to
the
make the wine.
The alternating proprietorship model will work for people to get access to a winery license without actually owning a winery, but then they have to make wine there.
Make wine or make all of the wine?
They have. Well, this is a we're getting to this when we get to the solution part. It's possible that in some states it may make sense for people to get a winery license, one or a group of people to get together and get a winery license, because if you have a winery license in the United States and you buy wine, whether it's foreign or domestic, you in Texas, for example, you can distribute that wine.
I think Blackbird
can send it can, but they also have distribution and importer licenses that not everybody will have, but.
Let's see what's next. We talked about this. It's a wine issue for direct shipping in New York. It's domestic wines can be sold directly to consumers in New York if you have a permit. They don't allow foreign-based wines, and they don't allow distilled spirits. That's an area that's probably going to loosen up at some point.
Right.
Let's see. Next slide, I think.
And maybe stand over here a little bit so that they can. I'm seeing people struggling to hear you back there.
Sorry for my laryngitis. Too much talking. I think there's going to continue to be inroads in this area over the course of time. It's, you know, slowly picking up some momentum. We know the wholesalers and the retailers are incredibly powerful, and they're going to be opposed to direct consumer shipping every step of the way. But there seems to be more of a popular interest in direct sales to consumers. And
just to add to that, one of the other things to think about is what's probably going to break this open is individuals wanting to buy wine has never been big enough to break the monopoly that the distributor and the wholesalers associations have. But Costco and Walmart and Trader Joe's are big players. And that those coupled with small wineries and with consumers may be enough to break some of the strangleholds.
I think that's a fair point, because that's exactly what happened in Washington. It was Costco that broke the system.
Yeah.
They spent years doing it. So you know, when you have big box retailers like that, they can offset the cloud of the wholesalers.
Because they want to sell direct to consumer and make that money also.
up till now, small wineries and us wasn't enough, but I think you may see some changes based on that.
Excellent. We talked about WSWA, talked about the retailers. New York, it's just an example. The Metropolitan Package Store Association is probably the one that's probably the office. In New York State, they are every state will refer to me, right in the front row, the chairman, right in the eye. And he thinks that these are controversial. They're the first ones to raise their hand. They like the system they have. They don't like inroads into it. So we talked about this. The internet providers are having some issues. In conclusion, I know this is probably not what you want to hear, but I think the three-tier system is going to stay. There's going to be some modest inroads, perhaps, over the coming years. But it's such an entrenched interest that goes back to really 1934. And I don't necessarily see the system collapsing anytime soon. So I think I have one more. We talked about MHW, so we'll talk about that. Oh, and then my funny comment, which maybe my grandchildren will see direct sales of Argentinian corn to consumers, but I don't think I'm going to be around to see it myself. So from here, you're going to talk about some ideas.
The idea was to have Mike give you the background and give you a sense of why this is so complicated. I think that one of the challenges we face is that for anybody that's going to do substantial distribution, who's in the wine business, Dr. Ravana, for example, who has a winery, the options for them are significantly greater, but that's because of their production, they've been able to offset or amortize the cost of having those licenses in a reasonable way. The system's not set up for somebody to ship small amounts of wine and be able to make a little bit of money on it. And so in order to fix that, we're going to have to get creative. And so what I'm going to talk about now and what I'd like to have an open discussion about is a little bit about how we might be able to fix that. And some of it's going to depend on how creative we all want to get. Here's my kid and my husband. Okay. And the other thing, so we'll talk about solutions is the idea now. I don't know if you guys have any questions for Mike now about what he presented or about this. A lot of you were here in the first session. If you weren't here in the first session, this idea of the three-tier system and the treatment of wine as a pharmaceutical, essentially, it may be surprising, but I don't know if there are any questions at this point or if you want to go straight into solutions.
Yeah, just one. Does the storage of the wine before it's sold play into any of these rules?
Depending on the state, yeah. I mean, some of the state have come to rest laws, where the product can virtually go through the wholesale market. It actually has to sit on the floor of the wholesale warehouse for a period of time, 24 hours. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. And
it does come into play.
Sure. And if it sits on the wholesaler in New York, it can't be shipped, sold to New Jersey.
No.
So they...
Then it's got to go to New Jersey and sit on the floor there,
which
and then it
can... theoretically could do. Wanted to merchandise in New Jersey, go back to the New York wholesale and say, I want to buy 100 cases back from New York to a really cost. Essentially, the cost can be sold for that. And then that merchandise can be essentially taken out of New York commerce and then resold to the New Jersey distributor.
But you either have to have, you then either have to be a new distributor in New Jersey or you have to have a distributor in New Jersey in order to do that.
Right. And that's, the state has their own regulatory system. Has to be a licensed entity that's only
There's a fair amount of push at this point. I mean, it's very contrary to what you see in all the other industries, but there is a fair push at this point to try to federalize the liquor laws.
I would love it, but I mean, under the 21st Amendment, each state has the right. They can even ban it if they want to.
Right.
There's still some dry counties in the United States. So states fight very hard for states' rights, so
yeah.
I don't see it being federalized.
Okay, so let's talk about, now we've talked about a lot about problems, let's talk about some solutions. I think it's important, again, to note it, to understand that we've got two types of owners for this commercializing world, three in total. There are some people who just want their wine to share with their friends and family and drink it for personal consumption. We've talked about that. I think that solution is done. I think we've got a solution there. Then we've got two kinds of commercializers. Casual commercializers and commercial commercializers. Anything less than about 600 bottles annually, I think you're talking, it's casual. And I think that your options are probably fairly limited to how we might be able to help you get some money out of the system and be able to sell your wines in your local wine store, friends and family, that sort of thing. If you're over 2,000 bottles, well, that leaves a gap, doesn't it? anyway, if you're over 2,000 bottles, you're in a position, I think, at that point where it's starting to make some sense for you to look at solutions like what John has, whether they're winery solutions or they are becoming your own distributor, getting some importer's licenses, and we can look at, and we'll look at those. The other thing is, I think that there's a transition here. I think there are a number of you who may be casual commercializers now, and you want to start sort of testing the market with your brand and that sort of thing, and that if you start to have some success, you might increase production. But I want to make it clear that I think at some point, whatever solutions we can provide to you now as a casual commercializer, you're probably going to, if you increase production, you're going to need to go ahead and get more formal about the fact that you're going to have a much bigger business that has more formal solutions. How does a winemaker usually commercialize his or her wines? We talked a little bit about this in the last one. It's important to understand that usually as a producer, you all are producers of wine. Usually the producer sells the wine, ex-seller, at the winery to a distributor who then takes on all of the inventory risk. They arrange for the importation and distribution of the wine. You sell it to them, you take your money, and you go plant, you go worry about next year's harvest. You don't work with them on anything else other than maybe increasing sales. You may go do tastings with them, you may help them in that regard, because obviously the more they sell, the more they buy, the more money you make. But you don't carry the inventory risk. The inventory risk shifts immediately. The distributor then, through its agents, through its employees, and its overhead, it stores the wine, it has the systems for moving the wine all over the state. It has people that go out into the state to the different retailers and sells the wine. They do the marketing, et cetera, et cetera. In that situation, you are out of the system, and the wine moves of its own accord through the distributor to the retailer and then to the end consumer. And the brand gets created essentially by the distributor, right? You have some control over it, but you aren't the primary driver at that point. What you guys want to do is something a little bit different, right? You want to be the producer, but you want to be very involved in, and you want to make it easy for the distributor to get rid of that wine, because you're going to be the ones that go out to the individual retailers. And for doing all that work, you either don't want to pay the distributor as much, or you want to share in some of the profits that come out of at the retail level. That's not normal. That's not the way it normally works, right? Because you, as the distributor, as the producer, normally take your cut at the front end, not at the back end. So what we're doing in trying to get you guys inserted into the system once it gets to the United States is unusual and not contemplated by the regulatory system. So the first and easiest option for the casual commercializer is our online store. Under this model, you can sell your wines direct to consumers, which I know you guys heard about the other day as being one of the best ways to do this. You will have a middleman here, and that will be Wine Direct, and us as a combined middleman. What we do is we give you an option to create, participate in the collective online store, a collective website with several owners' wines, or to create a custom website, and there's a middle option also. I'll go over in just a minute. The customers will visit the site, they order their wine, they pay for it with a credit card, and everything kicks into our back office with Wine Direct to fulfill that order, process credit cards, do state compliance, et cetera, et cetera. So if you've got 300 bottles and you want your friends and family to be able to enjoy it, you want to send 60 bottles to your house, you can tell us that, and the other bottles will go to the online store. And at that time, it goes up on the website, you tell your friends and family, you give them the URL, they click on it, they pay for it, it ships across the country, done. The money that gets, Nathan, you can help me with this part. At that point, when Wine Direct kicks the money back out to us, we will write you a check. We'll settle up with y'all quarterly and make sure, based on the orders that have been placed, and make sure that either we write you a check for the money that has been received, or a real possibility if your sales are low, is that the cost of the website maintenance and our fees are going to mean that you owe us money. So you, if you're going to choose this option, you guys need to be dedicated to moving that wine and promoting it, because that's not part of what we're doing. But if you guys are serious about it and you want to move those wines, and we can look at the numbers with you and run them beforehand to make sure that it does make sense for you to do it. One of the, you can get to all of these states. You'll notice that it's way short of 50. But these are the states that the online store can ship to right now. This list changes every day, or a lot, if that's the great exaggeration factor. It comes and goes. Some states come in, some states come out. It's very dependent on what legislation is being done, whether there's been a regulatory change or not. But we keep up with that and make sure that you know we don't ship wine through this system to any state that we can't get to.
The biggest problems there are New York and
Texas. Texas.
If you add in Texas and New York, you probably get 80% of the market for online sales.
And that's why I think that we can look at, especially given that that's where we have concentrations of owners, we can look at some individual solutions for that, both for direct-to-consumer and for standard three-tier distribution in both those states. That may be a possibility, or maybe we can work with wine.com. There are a number of options there.
Duffy, this is direct-to-consumer.
This is direct-to-consumer. This isn't selling to restaurants or package stores or anything like that. This is just direct-to-consumer. So this is, as I said, this is one of two solutions. The other solution lets you get to the retailers. There are three different kinds of stores and three different pricing models. I'll pass this out. If you guys want to talk about it in more detail, we can. But for now, I just want you to know that there are different options available, and they get more expensive as it gets more personalized. In addition to the website creation maintenance, we charge a fee for using this system. It's a 15% on revenues, or a dollar a bottle, whichever is greater. And what we do for that is really manage your store for you. We're the ones who go in and make sure that the SKUs are right. We make sure that all of the coordination with Wine Direct is done. We use our credit card processing. We do the accounting on it, et cetera, et cetera. There are additional services that we can offer in email blasts, marketing to your database, that sort of thing, that we'll work with you on a one-off basis with. So that is a solution for people who are casually interested in getting their wines to their friends and family mostly. Put it out on your Facebook, that sort of thing.
So does Wine Direct have a charge on top of the 15%, or is that just...
It's built in. The 15% is, it'll get into the Wine Direct charge is built into the website maintenance and into...
One direct charge for the online stores
in the variable
is
cost.
Taken on an individual shipment basis. So they're charged, they are the shipping handler. So every shipment you send out, you take out sales tax, retailer fees, wholesaler fees, out-of-state shipper fees, and shipping and handling, and then our fee.
The so that's on top of the 50%.
Yeah.
Or help me understand. So if a customer buys a $50 bottle of wine,
right,
you pay Bites, yep. $7.50. Does the customer pay for the shipping and handling, or does
the customer pays for the shipping?
Yeah,
and then who pays wine direct?
You do.
How much do you pay them?
No, no, we handle the wine. The wine. Okay, the way it works is the customer pays $50, but there's a strange system that is used by Wine Direct. It's called the Vintage Fund System.
Like an escrow account.
An escrow account that they hold. So we put our money in the Vintage Fund section, system, our fund, and they take out of that escrow account all of the fees, including their fee. They take out the retailer fee, the wholesaler fee, the shipping handling fee, and then the balance we're allowed to take. And we handle all that for you and do all the calculations, and we provide you with a report, and I'll send you all whoever's interested in these reports. And the balance after those fees, and then our fee, which is not a vintage funds, what comes out at the end is what you guys get. That didn't make sense.
No, so, does our 15% come out on revenue? It's on revenue.
Yes, it's on revenue.
So yes, it's on top.
So maybe you could, not today, but maybe you could just take a $50 bottle of wine, say, okay, the customer pays $63 because it ships or whatever,
right,
any state, whatever, and then say, okay, out of the $50, here's what would net to the owner. And you don't have to do that today, but it seems like that would be helpful for us to have.
I can give you examples. I can send you, because it depends on where you're shipping to also, right?
I understand.
If you ship to New York, ship to California.
Well, because the customer's paying.
Customer pays for that.
No, there's retail fees and wholesaler fees and
state compliance fees change from state to state. But shipping is generally paid for
by the client.
But yes, we can get you a breakdown. I'm trying to think about whether I have one with me. But so that's direct to consumer. And then the other, as everybody else is, we're interested in, is if you want to go to your local wine store, how do you do that? Can we help you do that? And as we talked about in the last session, it'd be one thing to allow a retailer to sell that wine, but absent some sort of system in place and some creativity, they can't give you any of the profit from that sale. And the reason for that is you theoretically got your cut when you sold the wine before export. And the whole system is set up, as Mike just spent 30 minutes telling us, to make sure that if you are not licensed, you don't get to make money on the sale and trafficking of liquor. The system is designed for that. The only way that you're supposed to be able to share in the profits of the sale of liquor in any particular state and in the United States is by getting a license, so that they can control you. And when you go to get a liquor license in the United States, in any of the 50 states, they look at, I mean, all of the questions are directed at whether or not you've ever committed a crime of moral turpitude. You know, they want to know what your business holdings are. They want to know who you are and what you are, and whether you are a good enough person to hold this license to distribute this potentially dangerous product, right? So with that in mind, if you want to take money out of the system without having a license, it's important to understand that that is exactly what the system's designed to stop. That doesn't mean we can't be creative, right? So, we have a way of doing this for small quantities of wine into a few stores for people. MHW is the importer. They sell to the distributor who sells to the retailer. When we do this for personal consumption, we set the price at which we suggest the price at which MHW will sell to the distributor who will sell to the retailer, so that when you buy the wine from the retailer, you pay X dollars, and that would cover only the importation cost and export, the importation and distribution cost. So that you pay the retailer and you get your wine.
The retailer takes his fee and pays the distributor. The distributor takes his fee and pays MHW. MHW pays itself the fees for importation and the importer's fees, and there are $0 left over. You have your wine and you can drink it and share it with your friends and family, but you can't sell it. And you've gotten no profit. If you want to stop at the retail level and you want to set the wine, we want us to tell MHW that your wine, that they should sell the wine instead of for $7 a bottle, they should sell it for $70 a bottle. And then the distributor pays $70 and $50. The retailer sells it to the distributor sells it to the retailer for $70. At that point, the retailer, when he pays the distributor and the distributor pays the importer's going to be left after everybody's taken their little cut. The importer is going to be left with money. We have an escrow account with that importer. The importer is going to return that money to us, to our Argentine company. Nathan is going to creatively figure out a way to make sure that you get a check from the Vines of Mendoza, whether that's from our Argentine company or a U.S. company, for the balance that's left over in the system, and that represents the profit that you would have made in the system. This works. You technically are complying with the three-tier system, and I think it would be very difficult for any regulator to figure out that you were taking money out of the system.
And we've done it about 8 times for about 8 different clients.
Yeah, and in small quantities.
Small being less than 2,000.
Way less, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we maybe moved 1,000 bottles.
Would it work the same for restaurants?
More than that.
Yeah, this will work for a restaurant. The restaurant buys it.
We did it for restaurants.
Yeah, the restaurant buys it. It's what you're doing is playing with the price, right? And what you're doing is the money is technically not coming back to you. You don't get the money. We get the money. The only issue in this, the issue here is that the prices are out of whack. They look funny on the books because they don't match up to what usually you see for an X dollar retail bottle moving through the system. Again, for small quantities, I think the risk here is relatively limited, but any real regulatory scrutiny on this may not hold up.
So, Debbie, what happens here, though, if you say, I want to get $30 a bottle, I cost this money, I want to get $30. So the distributor gives $30 to MHW, they take their liquor, there's, you know, $8 left there. So, but now the distributor, though, is stuck with a $30 bottle of wine that, you know, if the retailer doesn't want it or sell it or whatever.
You have to have already arranged that. You have to have already made your retailer agree to buy that wine. Otherwise, the distributor won't do it.
Right. So, because they're taking risk, lots of risk. Now,
they're not taking.
The distributor said that they could have a way around that. Is be creative, is he said, well, then, you know, we'll just have payment terms. Like, you know, I'll pay in 180 days. And so, you know, that was his creative way around how to resolve his risk, was to extend the payment terms so he basically is not stuck with inventory costs. I'm stuck with inventory costs. That was his suggestion.
He'll extend the payment terms to...
To who?
He'll get extended payment terms.
He gets extended payment terms, so he's no longer out the capital cost to... and then I have 180 days to sell the wine, basically. That, you see what I'm saying? That's his creative way of saying he's not out the capital.
Right.
You're out the capital, because you're not getting paid to the 180 days.
Yeah, but that's
that can't work because you have to have the wine imported, and in order to import it, you have to have already moved it in the system.
So right. He would buy it. He would agree to buy it. He's bought it.
But he's not paying MHW.
He's not paying MHW, and MHW is not going to give you 180 days to pay it.
Unless, you know,
something strange happens. Yeah. There are some other options. We've done this and it's worked. And as I said, for getting started, for seeing whether your brand's got legs, for your initial forays into your local restaurants, I think the system works. So hold on 1 second. Jeff?
I don't know enough about the licenses. brick-and-mortar distributor, distributor, retailer. If we go to a retailer, we get them to agree, yes, we want your wine, we want to be able to sell it. What type of relationships do they need to go back up to get that kind of information?
We take care of that. Well, we take care of that. We'll move it through the three-tier system. Your retailer will take care of it. They already have a distributor. So they'll have a deal with the distributor to move the wine in, and essentially you remove the inventory list because the retailer has already ordered the wine. You need to tell the retailer what wine, you know, they need to know what wine it is, they need to tell their distributor, and we need to be involved so we can coordinate with MHW to move it out of their warehouse to their distributor and the distributor to the retailer. Rich.
So this starts with us going to find five retailers, let's say, that want to sell the wine.
Right.
We agree on a price where we're selling it to them.
Right.
All right, so let's say it's 50.
I think what you want to settle on is your retail price, right? And what and margin.
Margin to the retailer?
To you, right? And then how much you're willing, right? How much do you want to make a bottle?
So let's say it's the retail price is $50.
It's fine, yes.
Also, he's the math guy.
Wait, we can also, they can also hold their wine in MHW, right?
The wine goes to MHW and right. It can just stay there.
So the wine is being held in
MHW. You get 30 days without paying storage, or 60. Might be 60. And then you pay a small amount, I think it's 6 cents a case, something like that. And it can stay there until you get an order. And that's when the chain starts.
So you decide, say you want $50 a bottle, is what you're saying. Then we would arrange it such that $50 goes to the district. That
you would have to add to that your cost, right? So you're going to have $12 a bottle, right?
Which
I don't know. Pick whatever your cost for making the wine.
Okay,
is,
right.
Right. You're going to have to add the cost of making the wine and all the cost of importation and distribution. Logistics, trucking.
Duffy, you're thinking of it. You want to sell it for 50, or you want to make
he wants
profit.
To make $50.
No, let's say I want to sell it. I want it to retail for $50.
Okay. Sorry, I understood you wanted to make.
$50. Okay, so $50 is what you want to sell it for. So the retailer will end up paying you to a retailer.
He wants the retailer to sell it to the shelf.
On the shelf.
Shelf price is $50.
To the consumer. Okay.
All right. Shelf price is $50.
On your feet.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking now about selling to consumers.
No.
That's what he's saying. It's on the shelf for $50.
No. He wants the retailer to sell it for $50.
Right.
Yeah.
He wants the retailer to sell it for $50. That's why I said I don't think the issue is how much you want it to retail for. I think you need to figure out how much you want to make. Then we set the price.
I'm using this example to see
how it works.
Yeah, and what the costs are embedded in a fifty.
You want to use $50? Okay, so $50 bottle sold from a restaurant from a wine store to a consumer, right? So that $50, the retailer has to pay the distributor. The distributor has to pay the importer, and you want some money left over, and you want to know how much money's left over on the back end. That depends on what deal you've reached with the retailer and the distributor to move that wine. In a standard, yeah, that's where I'm, okay. This is, I stole this, but I'm giving credit. This is a standard example of wine brand economics of markups through the different tiers. Your importer's margin, your distributor's margin, your retailer margin. So your $9.99 retail bottle price.
The important thing to note in our commercialization system is that you have to decide what it is you want to do, who you want to sell to. Because it has to do with assumption of risk, or as inventory, assumption of the inventory cost. If your business is to go around to different wine stores, if that's what you want to do, is go around to different wine stores and get them to buy your wine, right? Or go to different restaurants and get them to buy your wine. It's a different business than wanting to be able to sell to different consumers, which
right. So we're already past the consumer part. Right. We're
so
just on
you,
the retail.
If you want to go to just to the wine stores, then if it's $50, whatever you would use that, you would take a look at this margin. The retailer would want a 33% margin if you wanted to retail it. So you back that out, which means you could be down to what would that be?
$33.
So $33 that the retailer would have to pay to the wholesaler. And if using our commercialization process that we've developed, we would have the wholesaler take a small little piece of that. He would take a little fee.
Because there's no, this implies that the distributor has the inventory risk and the marketing costs. In
right.
our system, they don't.
Right. So instead of a 33 margin at the distributor level, they would take
much
less. Smaller margin on that. You'd still have to pay some. I'm sure there's some distributor tax in there. But it's still minor.
State tax and free.
Yeah. And then the distributor would end up paying that money back to MHW. We would pay
MHW
that would pay
pays
us.
It's $1 to $2 a bottle for export import costs.
And then they don't want a margin?
They won't take a margin in this case, the importer.
They're just covering
because they've
cost.
Already been
because they didn't pay us. They're not taking it.
They're not taking inventory
any money.
Risk. Again, this is a standard system where
right.
inventory risk shifts at each stage.
Right.
So what we've done is created a system where there's no importer margin or no distributor margin.
So that's good because the margin is at the retail level.
But there are fees at
right.
the other levels that
right.
we pay per bottle.
But back to the distributor. So if you've got a retailer again that's happy to buy your wine, if he's got a distributor he normally uses, he's still got to go to that distributor and say, because I'm going to take the risk off of you, I don't want you to charge me except your actual cost.
Or we have a distributor in your state that we already have to deal with, and you get the retailer to work with that distributor instead of the distributor that he usually works with.
Right. Retailers can use different distributors. They can use multiple distributors.
They don't like it.
Right.
But
yeah,
they
so
can do
you call up
the,
whoever
the risk
at
inherent in this
say,
system
this
is tied to the fact that the numbers look weird. Right, is that if any a regulator looking at these different levels is looking at the cost of the wine doesn't look like this.
Yeah.
And that's
the reason there's no margin, again, sorry to repeat it, and the reason there's no margin and that it's lower is because the importer doesn't take inventory risk, the distributor doesn't take inventory
right.
risk. The only guy taking inventory risk is the retailer who's
yep.
paying that $33.
Yep. So back in your example, Duffy, what numbers, just play with what, give us an example of what your numbers would be that look weird.
This number and this number would look very different in our system because it would go from this would be $27, not 12.
No. 12 is their margin. That would be $4.
Right, I'm sorry. This would be $4, $3.
Right. Price is just lower all the way through the chain.
And
exactly.
this would be
lower as well.
Way lower as well. And as a result, anybody looking at it, and regulator looking at a distributor's books at some point is going to say, why the hell did you do this to them? Because they're not making any money.
What?
And if they're not making any money, then someone's going to say, well, if you're not making the money, who is making the money? And when that question gets asked, then the question is, well, does that person have a license? Or are you just renting out your license? And that is called availing yourself of a license, and that is not so good.
But starting with the top price, you're backing into that price in order to leave the profit back with the buyers and with you.
Right.
Because you do end up at the same price to the retailer in the end. You
that's right.
That's right.
Wholesaler and the retailer margin, and you put it on the front end. But then you're also paying higher import tax and what have you. Must. You know what I mean?
Well, no. What,
no,
what, the
because
way this
the
works.
Export cost is still low because it's tied to your declared value.
Basically, the importer, okay, what it looks like to someone in the system is that the importer is making a lot of money.
Right.
Sure. And they're sending us a bunch more money through another mechanism. I don't think it's through the export mechanism. And then we circle back
right,
to you.
But there's nothing about the transaction and the importing that because the basis of the product is higher causes you any more cost.
No, not on that end.
Because normally in other products, if you bring them into the country and for whatever reason you would do it, you go in with a higher cost.
Right.
You can pay higher dues.
No, it's because in this case we can't do it like that because the wine is going to sit in the MHW's warehouse, so we don't know what the situation. You know, I don't know what you're going to go and sell to your local retailer for, or your local hotel.
The importing is tied to the alcohol percentage, and it's set per bottle for wine. For importation of wine, the federal duties are set, right, Mike? Federal duties are set by alcohol percentage, it's a set fee.
Yep.
So it's not tied to the price of the wine.
Got it. What would be on the same retail $50? What would be the what's the duty percent roughly on I don't know, whatever the 13.5%?
It's 44 cents a bottle and 36 cents a bottle, Jackie.
Okay.
I can look it up. I have it in the other presentation.
But it's a per bottle price based upon the alcohol rate level.
It all gets incorporated into it. In general, it's between $1 and $2 a bottle for your importer costs, and that includes federal taxes, state taxes, duties, drayage, customs agent fees, importer fee, and it varies based on the amount of wine in the container and some other things, but that's why it's between $1 and $2 a bottle.
So if the retailer says, all right, I'll try your wine, let me see how it sells, but I don't want to pay for it right now, this doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
Okay, and secondly, so what if the regulators bust this system? What happens at that point?
Run for cover.
I think the real risk lies, Mike, you help me with this, but I think the real risk is for the distributor and for the retailer. I think
as we had talked about it
in the store,
it's supposed to have
licenses. Yeah, MHW is the one at risk.
MHW is principally on the wholesale distributors online as well.
But MHW's entire business model is based on this. And they're careful because their contract with us says, essentially, I send them wine and they can do whatever they want with it. And that's the risk we all run when we send them their wine. If they went crazy, we would be in some trouble because I can't write a contract that says, you will, MHW, sell my wine for the price I give you, because then we're in antitrust violation issues, both federal and state.
Yeah, it's MHW that's on the line, but so I don't care if they go bankrupt. It's my business. If I were you, that's the way I look at it.
And I think to some extent, too, the fact that the money comes out into our account and that you aren't anywhere in this, you personally, I think is probably y'all's greatest protection,
yeah.
Right? I mean, they don't know about you.
Yeah, I'm sending.
How do they ever find out about you? Because the profit that's going back through that system comes to us.
Yeah,
we're the ones availing ourselves of the license, really, right?
So yes.
Sorry, Mike.
You're doing it through an Argentinian
organization.
Right. On your behalf.
I wanted to do it through a Cayman Islands organization, but that might raise some flags.
Yes. Paying all the taxes. I mean, all the taxes are being paid.
Taxes are being paid and collected. The only thing that's happening is that somebody who isn't licensed is making money out of the sale of liquor, and that's clearly what the whole system is designed to avoid. But someone has to care.
So my question, Ken. So if you own a restaurant, you have a retail license to sell drinks, right? In that case, right? It's your wine, so aren't you making money on the system? That's okay.
But you have a license.
No, I get that. All right, so when it goes to my answer, can't you just get a retail license then? And go, okay,
now
wine,
you
distributor, real distributor, my retail license, here we go.
To sell to consumers. But
sell
what if your business, yes,
yeah.
But what if your business, okay. What if you want to do, what if what someone wants to do is sell to a bunch of hotels and
no,
stores?
No, let's just say you don't. You said I'm happy.
So then that's fine.
So all I need is a retail license.
You need a retail license, and you need to make sure that you're not considered a supplier also, because then you're in a tight house situation.
Yeah, but you are a supplier. You're no more a supplier than a restaurant.
No.
You're
no.
The producer.
If
the
you
laws
make the
are
wine,
designed to avoid, remember, you've got
license,
the tier.
If I got my license, it needs to be on the restaurant. I own the restaurant 100%. You know,
And you also own the winery.
And you also own a
winery. I'm selling wines. And so I'm selling my wines.
If you're selling your wines, you are both a producer, supplier, and a retailer, and that's a tied house.
So some states.
Some states, yes. Some and some states have laws against that, including New York.
California?
I think so, actually. I just did some research on the other day for this, and it got so complicated I didn't want to get into it without having a real lawyer yet.
I think that this doesn't have that much risk attached to it, because the decision by the wholesaler and the retailer as to what markup or what price they're going to charge is theirs. The fact that there's more profit on the front end, who knows what the cost of making that bottle of wine is? That's an Argentina local thing to figure out, right?
And the U.S. has a long history of letting people make stupid deals. I mean, the legal system is designed to let you be an idiot. We respect your right to contract for stupid things. But I'm just, again, as we go about this, if you want to start your brand, if you want to start commercialization like this, I think this is a reasonable solution. If you want to build a major national brand based on this, we can't help you. Like, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good way to plan to start your entire business. And that's the difference I want to kind of draw to everybody's attention. Jeff?
Can you speak to, instead of using the retailer as a shop to sell your wines, using the retailer for a restaurant as a part of the market that wants to build a wine instead of a restaurant, and you're going to wine tasting and take the restaurant directly to online service. Is that appropriate?
It is. You can do that, and those are. That's up to the retailer, and as long as they're not selling the wine, as long as you're giving the wine away, maybe you donate the wine, and then they charge for the tasting. But you can work that out in each individual state, and the retailers will know exactly what they can and can't do in each particular state, and there are ways to work around that. I just went to a wine tasting for a winery here, actually. In Texas last Saturday at Fleming's, and they gave it was free tasting, but I'm sure they worked a deal out somewhere in that. So we don't do all this for free because it really does require a lot of coordination. So our fee for using this system that we have set up in our contract with MHW, and for us being the people that are in the chain and not you, is 2% of the net proceeds sent through the system and $50 a retailer. We send out the true up, which looks like this, that talks about exactly where all the costs are and what falls out at the end.
Is the wine stored at MHW in a climate-controlled environment?
Yeah.
And they'll arrange for climate-controlled trucking and the whole deal.
I have the online store breakup. We were talking about it before. So
okay.
Is that $50 per transaction plus 2%?
Per transaction.
Per retailer.
But if you send it, if you in May decide to ship four bottles or four cases, and in July ship another five cases, we'll do another $50 on that. So it really should say transaction, not retailer.
Yeah, can you explain, because I'm talking about, I have somebody who's wholesale.
Yeah. Distributor.
Your distributor who's willing to arrange to get and fix it. He's willing to get on those cases from the next.
Yeah, let me get to that just one second. There are other creative solutions, and we're working on some that we might be able to coordinate to help defray costs and that sort of thing. The idea of people getting their winery license, shared distributors, whether we become a distributor is something that we're putting on the table to try to figure out if that's really going to help solve the problem or not. But this is another option, and this goes back to the
it's good to know people with a boat instead of owning a boat, right? If you've got friends who are distributors, we can probably figure out some other things that make it work. Let me talk about that in just a second. Joe, did you have a question about what we've talked about until now?
I have a question, Jose. As you know, we live in Ireland, and it seems to me that trying to sell our wine from Mendoza, we bought 5 acres 6 or 7 years ago, but it seems to me that trying to sell our wine here in the United States would be pretty much a waste of space. Or am I correct in that? Or, I think we should be focusing on Ireland, United Kingdom, Netherlands, maybe Europe, wherever. But would you agree or disagree with that?
I think that unless you're willing to go absolutely full out dedication to commercializing a big brand in the United States, it's then yes, you should focus on. And again, this goes back to what we're just about to talk about. Knowing people in the system is what's going to make you guys be able to drop your prices. You're going to be able to cut fees out based on personal relationships, not the system, because the system's not designed to allow for commercialization of really small production. It's just not.
Yeah, thank you.
So, example, South Carolina, a very difficult state for wine distribution. These guys have a friend who's a distributor who's willing to, once the wine comes into MHW, they'll order the wine from MHW, they'll bring it down, and they say, we'll take the inventory risk. Wink, wink, nod, nod. I think I can get rid of 100 bottles or 200 bottles tomorrow. And I'm guessing from the way you describe this that in South Carolina you can be both a distributor and a retailer. Otherwise, I think this might be a little more complicated.
Yeah, I don't have to answer that because I never called it. But I assume there's a way because I've been to wine events that they have, that they put on at a facility. And so if you want to go taste the wine and if somebody wants to buy it,
they can buy it straight.
Then they can buy it by placing an order. And I don't know if the order goes through, say, the restaurant where you went and had their wine tasting or through the country club where they did.
But in any event, they think that they can sell this wine and it's not a problem and they're willing to do it and they're willing to share whatever the profit is on that sale with their friend, who's you. In that case, the question is, the distributor's taking all the risk at that point because if he pulls money out of his pocket and gives it to an unlicensed person, he's got a risk. So what do you do to mitigate your friend's risk? Well, I'm sure your friend, the distributor, needs some kind of consulting services, right? Unrelated to the sale of your wine. And the fact that it happens to equal the amount of dollars that you agreed upon, probably nobody's ever going to know the difference. Right? I mean, again, these are all very creative solutions. I don't recommend building your business model around them. But if you're not willing to commit to a full-blown commercial operation in a highly regulated industry that is expensive, then you guys are going to have to take some risks too, and so are your friends. And I think that's the only fair way to say it. Yeah, I think that works, and we're looking at that. That's on our agenda next. And I think that then brings you into this level of not being a casual commercializer, which is that you're going to have to be even more creative, and puts you into a category of being a commercializer, a serious commercializer, where you, at least with the volume of the other people that you're combining with, reach a level where the costs start to make some sense. I'm about to move into the cost of becoming your own distributor and what goes into becoming your own distributor. Does anybody have any other questions about what we just talked about? Short on time? 90 seconds?
just to work casual sellers.
try to reach one of those.
What are they? We'll say 10 cases.
Usually it's fees. I mean, they'll usually give you a slap on the wrist and they'll fine you. But the powers of both state and federal governments. Yes. And the other thing is that they actually have some pretty broad-reaching injunctive relief that would allow them to prevent you from even legally importing your wines if you had an incident of having illegally distributed your wines, right? So that even if you make a mistake, and because remember that these licenses are privileges, so even if you go and correct your mistake and get your license, they can say, yeah, but you had this on your record, not you. Again, when we're talking about small quantities, one-off situations with friends who are retailers and distributors, I think your risks are pretty low. But I do think that if you want to get into the business of selling wine, then you need to think about it like, I can manufacture your widget for you, but it's pretty rare for me when I manufacture your widget to come to me and say, well, now how do I sell it? In those situations, that's where lawyers, accountants, all that other stuff have to kind of come into play. Barry, one of the distributors.
I am the distributor, so yes, I just wanted to emphasize what you said. I've been selling your wine, and I essentially do it by hand. But I have a very strict rule along with what you said. If I do not know that person personally, and they go to my wine website, and they want to buy that wine, I do not sell it to them. I say, you've got to go here or there, or I can't sell it to you. I'm just missing whatever it is. The only time I ever went to anybody, only people I have a personal relationship with, and I know. Because I would not take the risk of selling somebody I don't know and getting stuck or whatever. I highly recommend what Duffy said, do not sell to people you don't know do any type of thing.
It's a bootlegger.
Another good point.
The minute I became a distributor, I became a bootlegger.
Never use that word again in public.
Yeah.
I put it through a corporation, a little complicated. I actually got audited, and I would have to share that experience. But I do not screw around federal government and taxes. I claim every single dollar that comes in that actually goes into that corporation, got reported as taxable income, and I get taxed on it. All the wine that I was selling that year, all in compliance, essentially, was personal wine that I had, all that I was doing that. It's just not worth it. What other experience do you say I'm distributed? Like, you talk about the Massachusetts.
I should have had the music geared up to play Welcome to the Jungle. I'm around, we're creative. I guess I should have stopped on this slide. Nada es imposible, right? That's where we came from, that's what we believe, and I think we can actually solve this. And we can make it more economically viable than we have in the past, so that you can think about how to get some production going. And I'm open to ideas and thoughts. Mike and I and Nathan are going to sit down right now and talk about what some of our options might be and how to structure these to keep the risk as limited as possible for everybody. So, go make a bunch of wine. Next session is in here, Michael.
What time?
15 minutes. Yeah. But you can eat while you do.
Right.
Okay.
So you're on your
own. So I was reading in here that California had changed the laws that if you go out and get a production license, then you can sell to a distributor and sell back to some restaurant.
Do you know?
We don't have a bottle of data. Maybe, but then you have to pay fine.
So what's the risk for us if we sell it in there? That we could potentially lose our
retailer license?
Yeah.
But, you know, we need to figure out maybe you guys create a different entity or something like that for the production side. We need to look at how best to do that.
So, for example, like it is a different entity in Argentina?
Mm-hmm.
Like the entity in Argentina?
Maybe the vineyard is held in a different name, or maybe, without sitting down and knowing everybody involved in each state, it's all going to happen. But, for instance, we've got a guy, Matt Cott, out of Southern California, who got his importer's license. He makes the wine, and he's knocking on doors in several ones. Importer and a distributor, but you can't be a retailer. So I've never had a situation where I've had the retailer but not the other two, right? So like I don't know the answer. But I'm sure there's a way to make this work.
Yeah.
Maybe Matt Collins.
So I'm in a different company as they are. So I mean, maybe if I made the initial list in Argentina to get them to their restaurant.
Maybe Matt Collins buys your wine for you. He's an importer in Southern California. He buys your wine and then you buy it back from him. And you just adjust the price.
Where would we be able to get help for you guys with that?
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about it, but honestly, you need a California lawyer.
For me to make $6,
we have one. Okay. We have an in-house counsel.
They can figure this out better than I can because I've got 50 different states
right.
And all that other
stuff. So should we have him just be in contact with us and you? Because he's actually working on it right now. I've been feeding him information.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
We have time, you know.
Exactly.
Well, mine is, I have mine at 29.
We're doing things that
So if I want to get 28, in your example, I have to sell 53. In my example, I said 57. Right?
So just know that you're going to be patient. It's just going to be a little bit of a